to session 4 of Depression and Anxiety Recovery. To review, we've been giving you some solid information about how our hardware of the brain works and how to get our hardware working optimally. That includes the synapses and the connections and the brain biochemistry. But today we're going to be switching gears and talking about the software of the brain. In order for our computers to work well, we not only need to have a great computer, but we especially need to have great software. What is the software of the brain? It's the thinking portion of the brain. And thus the title of this presentation, How Thinking Can Defeat Depression and Anxiety. And this goes into the area of emotional intelligence, which has so much to do with how we are thinking. Emotional intelligence contributes more to successful and enjoyable living than even IQ does. IQ is our ability to learn, retain, and apply knowledge, critically important, but far more important, we have found, is emotional intelligence. And since it's learned rather than inherited, IQ has a lot of inherited components, not so much with emotional intelligence. Since it is learned, it can be improved upon by everybody, and that is good news. There are 5 components of emotional intelligence. The first is knowing our emotions. That means to be able to identify what we're feeling, but also why we're feeling that way. And if the why just has to do with the fact that someone cut you off in traffic, you're not understanding your emotions. Because although that had a role to play, it's your thoughts about what they did that are actually causing your emotions. And so we are in ways responsible for our own emotions. And so it takes a while sometimes for people to understand their role in their emotions, to know those well. The second aspect of emotional intelligence is managing our emotions. People with low emotional intelligence are being managed by their emotions. Day by day, moment by moment, they're being managed by their emotions. People with high emotional intelligence still have powerful emotions, but the difference is that they're managing those emotions. And that spills over to an area that's very important for all of us. If we're going to have comprehensive self-control, we need to be able to manage our emotions. And how successful you are throughout life, as well as how happy and fulfilled you are, has a lot to do with your managing your emotions in order for you to have self-control. The third aspect of emotional intelligence is recognizing emotions in others. As you might imagine, emotional intelligence is not just about you, it's about others. And being able to empathize with others is a crucial role. And that's about managing relationships with others, the fourth aspect of emotional intelligence. And then finally, the final aspect comes from the word emotion itself. Emotion has another word in it. That's motion. And if our emotions are based on what's true and accurate, it will powerfully motivate us to achieve our goals. And this means health goals, including our mental health goals. And if we're well motivated, you can see how much better we're going to do long term in our overall brain health and in our relationships, as well as in our accomplishments and how many accomplishments we might have. So there are a number of factors that affect emotional intelligence. Our genetics has a role to play. Our childhood experiences do have a role to play. What type of attachments we formed early on in life. Our emotional support now has a role to play, as well as lifestyle factors such as we have discussed in previous sessions, but also our thoughts have a crucial role to play. In fact, out of all of those who have studied emotional intelligence and all of the studies tell us the thoughts are even more important than some of these other things. And that's why we want to spend a lot of time talking about our thoughts and the software of our brain. So why is our thinking important? Well, a cognition is actually a thought or a perception. Your cognitions are the way you are thinking about things at any moment. And these thoughts have a significant impact on how you're feeling, which and then, in turn, relates to your behaviors and has a very powerful effect on how you're behaving. Your thoughts have a tremendous amount to do with your personal emotional intelligence. And so the gold standard of psychotherapy that can help us in all of these things is called cognitive behavioral therapy. That's really thought behavior therapy, if we were to break that down. CBT is what it's abbreviated at. So why is it considered the gold standard of psychotherapy? Because there have been so many studies done on it, randomized controlled studies, where we take two groups, we have them undergo different types of therapy, and then we follow them over time. Traditional psychotherapy does not come out so well when it's studied in that manner, but cognitive behavioral therapy does in a lot of different areas. CBT helps people change how they think for the better. And if you change your thoughts, you will naturally change your emotions and behavior. Cognitive behavioral therapy will focus on current life rather than past life events. A lot of traditional psychotherapy goes into your past, and it's kind of an unending process, where cognitive behavioral therapy is more interested in what you're thinking now. It does, of course, concern you with your past as well, because it has a role to play on how you're thinking, but only in regards to that relationship of how you're thinking now. So thoughts are evaluated in the context of being helpful or harmful, positive or negative. And so one of the things we want you to learn how to do is to stop and analyze your thoughts. Just that process of analyzing your thoughts, looking for distortions in those thoughts, and trying to replace those thoughts with more accurate thoughts starts to improve the gray matter in our frontal lobes. This is the area that's very crucial for managing our emotions, and that's a side benefit that we didn't expect until we did these studies. Cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown in controlled trials to effectively treat depression, anxiety disorders, anorexia, bulimia, even personality disorders. This is something that's pretty amazing, because previous to CBT, most people thought personality disorders were doom and gloom. You had that, there was no way you were going to change. But improving the software of your brain can improve and even eliminate the problems that come with all of these personality disorders. In addition, CBT has been shown to effectively help marital issues. In fact, many have found this course to be more enhancing to their marriage than marital counseling or even going through a marriage enrichment program. Why is that the case? Because the number one cause of marital discord are our thoughts and our feelings. And once our thoughts and feelings are fixed, the marriage is fixed. And that is, of course, a wonderful thing. And then it also has been shown to effectively treat addictions. In fact, one of the most powerful addictions that can grip people and even kill them is alcohol. And we all know, I think, about the most popular program for getting rid of alcohol in an outpatient setting. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that program teaches many individuals that they need to stick with it, because the first year of sobriety is going to be the worst year of their life. And then it will start to get better. Why is it the worst year? Because they're used to numbing their thoughts. But when they're not numbing them, they have a tendency to get into stinking thinking. Well, the good news is that if you do cognitive behavioral therapy, you can correct your stinking thinking. And then your first year of sobriety will actually be the best year of your life, and it will only get better from there. And so the studies show if we combine CBT with like AA, it will improve your odds of overcoming alcohol by fourfold. And if it does that with alcohol, it can do it with so many other addictions. And this is why I would encourage you once again, if there's something you want to give up, this is a good time to do it when you're going through that program, because we will be able to help you on the software part of these addictions as well. So the benefits of cognitive behavioral therapy have also been shown in scientific studies to be as at least as effective as drug therapy. No physical side effects. Makes relapse less likely than drug therapy. And in combined with treatment with antidepressant medication, CBT appears to be more effective than treatment only with antidepressant medicine. So once again, it's not a choice of medicine or CBT. It can be both, and it can actually improve panic disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder when combined. It also makes staying free from mental illness more probable if you have overcome it through utilizing CBT, and it changes brain chemistry. Why is that? Because it can help us manage stress so well, and when we manage stress, we're able to produce more serotonin and more brain chemicals, which can then help us even further in managing stress. So traditional forms of psychotherapy, Dr. Ellis and Dr. Beck, who were psychologists who discovered this whole cognitive behavioral therapy concept, tell us traditional psychotherapy is more like crooked thinking. So crooked thinking goes into your activating event and those again go straight into how that event caused you to have an emotional consequence. And that emotional consequence then caused you to have a behavioral consequence. This is what we call A to C thinking, and it tends to be associated with negative automatic thoughts. In fact, you just think an event happens, or you even have a memory come out forward, and it goes right into the negative emotional consequence. And we're missing something greatly with crooked thinking. In fact, Dr. Ellis says, crooked thinking is believing that we have little or no ability to influence our feelings and that events and situations directly cause our emotions and behavior. So the typical person does not even try to listen to their thoughts in this situation or even try to analyze them to see if they're helpful or accurate. And if you don't consciously think the thought, the cognition can trigger you to feel a certain way. And that's why we have this false belief about many of our negative automatic thoughts. So what are some of the thoughts that we can have? Common thoughts are you're not smart enough, successful enough, attractive enough, or talented enough to feel happy and fulfilled. Or you believe your negative feelings are strictly due to others, what others have said or what others have done to you. And you know, all of these thoughts have the tendency to make us victims because we think the causes result from something beyond our control. In contrast, we can change the way we think about things, and we can also change our basic values and beliefs. And when we do, we will often experience lasting changes in our mood, outlook, and productivity. So we still have the activating event, but now we have the belief, and if that belief changes into a rational belief, unlike some of those irrational beliefs we talked about, the emotional consequence can immediately change, and then our behavioral consequences can also immediately change. So one of the ways of thinking and helping us analyze our thoughts is to ask yourself some questions. Is your belief true? And is it true all the time? And is it helpful? Often our thoughts are not helpful. These negative automatic thoughts are not even helpful. And of course, if we analyze them, they're not even really completely true. So your belief determines your consequence. As you change the way you think about things to become more rational, accurate, true, and helpful, the more often you will experience lasting positive changes in your mood, in your outlook, in your relationships, and in your productivity, and life in general becomes much better. So we need to learn how to identify our cognitive distortions. And there are 10 major ways of thinking distorted thoughts. We all have this tendency to think distorted thoughts. There's not a person on the world that thinks true and accurate thoughts moment by moment, day by day, 24 hours a day, or however long they're awake. We all have a tendency to, at times, think irrational and distorted thoughts. And whether we have mental illness or not has to do with what percent of the time we are thinking more distorted thoughts. So let's go into these 10 categories of distorted thinking. The first one is all or nothing thinking. This is believing that there is no in between. It's completely one way or the other. And all or nothing thinking puts things into extremes or absolutes, like black and white or good and bad. It makes sweeping assumptions like, I am right and you are wrong. And it can cause people to have difficulty accepting anything less than the best. It can set unrealistically high expectations of yourself that can never be met. And of course, it can also give us trouble in even acknowledging mistakes. What would be an example of this? The thought that I'm a total failure. How can we actually reframe this? I'm reasonably good at some things. No matter who you are, I know that reframe is actually accurate. Some of us are good at other things, but everyone is reasonably good at some things. And so this idea I'm a total failure is actually a distortion of thinking, but yet it's very common among those that are feeling hopeless and have a lot of depression. Another distorted way of all or nothing thinking, I'm too out of shape for this exercise program. I guess I'll give up because I can't do this. We've had many individuals decide not to exercise because they think they're just not in shape enough for it. But how about this? I don't have to do all the routine at once. Just doing some exercise each day will make a difference, and I can start to build from there. You can see how reframing can get rid of some of the complications of all or nothing thinking. What are those complications? Procrastination. What is the procrastinating thought? If I can't get it all done now, why even start? And so we don't get it done little by little. All or nothing thinking inflates problems. It causes frustration. It causes pessimism. And it can even cause discouragement. And the ultimate all or nothing thought is a suicidal thought. So tips for recognizing and correcting all or nothing thinking. Watch out for these type of words: everything, all, must, nothing, useless, awful, totally, and practice seeing things more in shades of gray. A second very common distortion is overgeneralization. And this is using limited factual evidence to support a belief that actually is not true. We think because something bad happened once or twice, it will repeatedly happen every time. And people that overgeneralize hold the hypothesis as a fact rather than just a hypothesis. One of the common distortions that I have heard: the girl I have a crush on didn't want to go out with me. I'll never find a girl I like who will accept me. I'm going to be lonely the rest of my life. This actually happened to a friend of mine in pre-med, but I've heard it since that time. And to reframe this, it would be just because she said no to going on a date doesn't mean that all likable girls will say no. I do have a lot to offer. And so this is a more balanced thought instead of overgeneralizing based on a few instances and using limited factual information. I've heard this one before as well. The whole university knows that Dr. Wang is a terrible teacher. What? The whole university knows that? And he's still teaching there? How about this? Many students are not satisfied with Dr. Wang's teaching style, But most students who put in the time are still learning a lot, and Dr. Wang is actually good at answering most questions the student asks. And so we might not like some things about him, but these things are very true and can be documented as such. And that first distortion is really not accurate, and it can produce all sorts of emotional pain and discord by you believing those sorts of things. So once again, on overgeneralization, you want to watch out for the words always, never, everyone, quotes, no one, quotes. Those are a sign that we could be overgeneralizing. A third distortion, very common, is one of a mental filter. This is where we single out one aspect of a situation to the complete exclusion of others that should be considered. And everything tends to go through that filter. A mental filter is like a sieve you perpetually pass events through. And as a result, all events have meaning and context based on an invalid application of a past experience. This is very common, by the way, with PTSD. People with post-traumatic stress disorder virtually all have a mental filter due to the traumatic experience that they had to suffer through. And so everything is put through this sieve, and events have meaning based on that one application of a past experience. And this has a way of smudging and distorting and obstructing your view of current and future experiences, and can cause disappointment and make us afraid of helpful new approaches to experiencing life. A negative mental filter focuses only on the negative aspects of a situation and filters out all of the positive ones. Where a positive mental filter occurs when you pick one or two positive details from a situation and dwell on them exclusively, and then perceive the entire situation to be positive as a result of those one or two positive aspects. And so both can actually be harmful because we're not seeing the whole picture. We have a tendency to have this tunnel vision. And that tunnel vision can be negativity, or that positive mental filter can result in poor decision making, since you're not looking for and weighing the evidence of both the pros and cons. And we want to weigh the pros and cons of situations accurately so that we can indeed make well-informed decisions. Mental filters will lead to more depression and anxiety as well. So let's take an example. My boss's review was full of criticism. That's what you're thinking as you're getting out of that annual review, and that's what you're telling the people that are close to you. How about this? My boss gave me some positive feedback with areas to improve on. And by the way, if your boss thought so badly of you, you probably would have been fired. The fact that you kept your job means that he or she thinks there's good hope for you and wanting you to work on those things so that you can become even a better employee. How about this? My son is the best manager his company has ever had. Well, it's nice to have a son like that and believe that, but the reality could be he is a respected businessman, but he's still human and has areas in which he can grow professionally and personally. And look at your son in a more balanced way, because if you don't, chances are you're going to be sorely disappointed if you think the first way exclusively, and then when the chickens come home to roost, you know what I mean. So tips for overcoming mental filter: intentionally and forcefully look for evidence that supports a different way of thinking. This is not always easy, and we tend to have these mental filters, and so it's good to stop and say, let's be intentional and forceful to look for evidence to support a different way of thinking. Ask yourself if you're taking the entire picture into consideration. If there's a positive side that you are overlooking, or if you're engaging in too many activities that dwell on the negative. A fourth common cognitive distortion is mind reading others. Having the certainty of knowing what another person is thinking without even asking. A lot of people get into this. And interestingly, we have a tendency to mind read those that we don't know very well, even more so than ones that we tend to know well. And there's a risk to mind reading. When we start mind reading, it's going to affect our social life if we're not checking things out. Because we are reading the intention of others, we think they can read their heart, and we are going to have some serious misunderstandings. Mind reading has actually been studied, and it turns out that if you don't know the people well, and you see the looks on their faces, and you saw what just happened to them, there's only a 1 out of 4 chance you'll be right. That's not very good. That means human beings are very poor mind readers with strangers or those they don't know well. What about if it's your loving spouse and you have lived with this loving spouse for 30 years and you've seen those expressions and you've seen how he or she relates to the situation? Are you going to be a better mind reader than that? You will be a better mind reader, and it'll be a 4 out of 5 chance you'll be right with those that you're very close to. But still, that's not 100%. If you think you can read your spouse's mind 100% of the time, even after 30 years, you're going to have some marital discord as a result of thinking that you can do that. There's also been studies on men and women. Who do you think are actually better at accurate mind reading? It turns out they're equal. There's no gender advantage when it comes to reading the minds of others. So let's get into a common mind reading distortion. He should have known that I was upset about that. And of course, that can make you very angry. He should have known I was upset about that. How about this? I cannot expect others to know what I'm thinking. If you can't know what they're thinking, you can't blame them when they don't know what you're thinking. Another distortion. You're only saying that because you feel bad for me. Really? You know their heart so well that that's exactly the reason why they said that to you? How about this? I don't really know why she said that. That's much more accurate, and we don't have to know 100% of the time why people are doing what they're doing. We don't want to jump to conclusions. That will often produce some adverse effects. So tips for overcoming mind reading: try acting contrary to your thought. You may get a result you don't expect. If you're feeling, for instance, like avoiding eye contact, instead, approach the other person and introduce yourself. Listen to others. Don't make assumptions. Just base on what they're thinking. And when you are not sure what they're thinking, you might even ask them, "What are you thinking?" instead of just going into those assumptions. Very closely related to mind reading is fortune teller error. Both of these fall under a category called jumping to conclusions. And as one psychologist pointed out, we have a tendency to have this be our form of exercise. Jumping to conclusions is much more common than actually physical exercise. And Stephen Wright says, when you're tired of thinking about something is when people jump to conclusions. But it's okay not to know exactly why or really what exactly is going to happen. Fortune teller errors believe if this happens, then that will definitely occur. And have you ever been guilty of imagining the worst? We call that catastrophizing. People with anxiety have a tendency to imagine the worst and just think the worst will happen. We've even had patients cancel vacations because they just knew that the plane was going to crash as they were going to some vacation place and stop their whole family from getting on that plane, and no crash occurred or anything like that, but they were catastrophizing. They were jumping to conclusions and going into this fortune teller error. Imagining the worst case scenario can cast a doom and gloom mentality into our lives, create negative self-fulfilling prophecies often, and produce anxiety as well as strained relationships. One of the distortions can be also about others. I know he won't do it because he'll think it's too hard. This is the cardiologist who has a patient with advanced coronary disease and knows that a plant-based diet could reverse that coronary disease, but says, I'm not going to tell my patient because there's no way he's going to get on that diet. He's just going to think it's too hard. That fortune teller error prevents the patient from learning something that he would have been able to make the decision whether he was going to do it or not. And so often it's paternalistic attitudes that get in the way of actually helping other individuals. What would be the correction of this? He may not have liked doing hard things in the past, but that doesn't mean he won't try this new challenge, particularly when it might save his life. Another common distortion, I've had two panic attacks in the store now. I know that I'm going to have a panic attack every time I go shopping now. Does that mean for sure you're going to have a panic attack because you've had two panic attacks in the store before? To reframe this, just because panic attacks have happened to me before doesn't mean they'll happen again. I'm also learning skills to help me manage my anxiety, and I can practice those before and while shopping and see if I can go shopping without a panic attack this time. This will be a lot healthier way of looking at the situation. So if you're tempted to do fortune teller, ask yourself, what's really the worst thing that could happen? And remind yourself that you don't really know what will happen. And if the worst thing did happen, would you be able to do something about it or manage it? Try keeping track of how many times you've actually been right and how many times you've been wrong when you have tried to do fortune telling. And is your fortune telling more helpful or is it more harmful to you? And also evaluate the quality and the actual evidence for your claim. People with anxiety and panic do have this strong tendency for fortune teller error. And I actually equate it to going skiing. You know, an individual that goes skiing, and of course, we're actually filming here in California, not too far away from Lake Tahoe, but you can actually be going up a chairlift and you can start seeing some rocks and cliffs as you're going up over this chairlift. You can see some pretty bad ways to go down that slope. And when you get to the top, if you're actually looking around at all of those cliffs and all of those bad ways, what's going to happen? You're going to tend to ski that direction. And you could have all sorts of anxiety and fear. But you can also go up that same chairlift with all of those bad ways of going down and realize, I'm not even going to think about going down those ways. I'm just going to think about going down the actual ski slope and staying within the lines of that ski slope. That's a more skilled imagination. So people with anxiety tend to have a runaway imagination, but a skilled imagination will just imagine you going down the right way. And when you imagine that, it's very easy to go down the right way and not run into any of those disasters that could occur. And so we're not catastrophizing. Another common one is emotional reasoning. This is the thought that your feelings don't lie. And this occurs when you let your emotions determine your behavior as well. Emotional reasoning is a distortion that is the primary reason why so many people don't break addictive habits or change deleterious lifestyle habits. They have this belief that it's their feelings don't lie, and their addictive behavior alters their feelings in ways that seem positive on the surface. And they say, I don't feel like giving this up. I don't feel like it's going to necessarily make me feel good short term. And so it's all about feeling good short term, but in the long run, it's making them feel far worse. People feel unable to change, and so they don't. And feelings come and feelings go. Feelings are deceiving. And it's easier to put off difficult tasks or decisions often than face them. And so we really need to work on emotional reasoning. Emotional reasoning will also lead to procrastination. I don't feel like working on it now, and so I don't. Our children quickly learned growing up that they could not give a reason why they weren't doing something because they didn't feel like it. Because emotional reasoning is very distorted way of thinking, but it's very common today. I feel conspicuous and too out of shape to go to the gym. I'm staying home. Reframe with, I'm not competing with those who are fitter than I am. I know exercise is good for me, and today I get to choose healthy behaviors. Plus, my body actually feels good after working out. That is getting rid of emotional reasoning. Jonathan Martinson says, feelings are much like waves. We can't stop them from coming, but we can choose which one to surf. How do we choose the one to surf? The one that's based on true inaccuracy. So we need to elevate our feelings to our frontal lobe and say, is this feeling based on things that are completely true and accurate and helpful? Also, Thomas Jefferson, the founder of the Democratic Party, said something very profound that I think is worth memorizing. Hopefully you'll memorize it in during these 8 weeks. He said this, don't bite at the bait of pleasure until you are sure there is no hook beneath. Don't bite at the bait of pleasure. In other words, don't go into emotional reasoning unless you are sure there is no hook beneath. Think of all the problems that we'd be able to solve in our society if people actually went through that before they bit at pleasure. Another emotional reasoning, cleaning the pantry is too overwhelming. I'm not in the mood to tackle it today. What? Let's reframe that thought. It's not a helpful thought, nor is it entirely accurate. Reframe it by saying the entire pantry may take some time, but I will do my best, beginning with the shelves closest to the door, and see how much I can get done in 30 minutes. And you may surprise yourself significantly with this. Now, people with anorexia also tend to have emotional reasoning. Their emotional reasoning is this: I feel fat, therefore I am fat. And with that conclusion, they'll cut down on their calories or even quit eating altogether, which can even threaten their life because they're already malnourished because of that emotional reasoning. So emotional reasoning actually ignores facts based on the weight of evidence. And this is also called a disorder of assumption. So emotional reasoning and disorders of assumption runs together, and that is they're assuming they're fat and they're not looking at the weight of the evidence. Of course, the solution when they come to a therapist is to have not that therapist say, actually, you are fat. If you feel fat, you must be fat, and so you should quit eating. That therapist could then be responsible for helping the patient to kill themselves in the process. So the therapist actually has to help them to see reality from the right perspective. When I was growing up, there was an emotional reasoning song that I actually liked. You light up my life. You give me strength to carry on. You light up my day. But I realized there was something wrong with the lyrics of that song when at the very end, the last thing that I think it was Debbie Boone sang was, it can't be wrong when it feels so right. Wait a minute, that's emotional reasoning. It can't be wrong when it what? Feels so right? Yes, it can, because feelings can be very deceiving. And we can get into a lot of trouble when we're in this belief to just go with our feelings. So tips for overcoming emotional reasoning. Work on identifying assumptions and consider what evidence you have for or against your emotions. And act on informed reasons rather than impulse. There's a little song that we sing sometimes to help us with our emotional reasoning that has become so common today. Feelings come and feelings go, and feelings are deceiving. To drive away unpleasant thoughts, use CBT unceasing, because feelings come and feelings go, and feelings are deceiving. CBT can change bad thoughts and help you when you're failing. And that song just helps us to realize that feelings can be very deceiving, and we need to stop and practice cognitive behavioral therapy. So how do we do this? We want to listen to our thoughts. That means don't go straight from events or memories to emotional consequences. Let's start analyzing the in-between, that be part of things. Listen to what your thoughts are telling yourself, and then begin to analyze those thoughts. Identify the emotions, maybe, and then work backwards. Sometimes it's good, if we're feeling those emotions, to work backwards and say, what am I thinking that's actually causing those emotions? What comes to mind when I am experiencing these emotions? And what thoughts do I have about this situation that actually upset me? And once we get there, we can start to analyze those thoughts, which will be very helpful. Step two, analyze your thoughts and label any distortions. Ask yourself, is the thought accurate? Expectations realistic? Is there another way to look at the problem or situation than the way I'm looking at it now? Is there evidence to support a different way of thinking? And am I making myself upset about something beyond my control? You might say, well, what's wrong with that? First of all, it's not helpful to get yourself upset about something that's beyond your control, but you're also wasting a lot of emotional energy that you could use to bring about positive change in other areas. And this emotional energy will drain you and will prevent you from thinking of ways that could be positive ways of dealing with even problem situations. And then these last three are crucial. Is the thought accurate? Is the thought helpful in achieving my goals? Does the thought help me feel the way I want to feel? If any of those are no in the last three, it's a distorted thought, and you need to look for the distortion so you know how to reframe it. Now, you might say, well, I'm not feeling positive about this situation, but I don't want to think positively about it because it's going to help me motivate myself to do better. So that might be a good reason to not feel good about a particular situation, and that could be helpful in achieving your goals, and it could be accurate. So it doesn't mean you always have to feel positively. You just want to make sure that you're feeling the way you want to feel, and it's accurate, and it is helpful. Once you find the distortion, it's time to reconstruct your thinking. A reframe, restructured belief or thought is one based on what's true, accurate, rational, helpful, and hopeful. And it's good to test your thoughts against the truth in ways by saying, on what facts do I base this notion? What are the most effective arguments I can come up with to contest this notion? So in other words, be good at debating yourself when you come up with notions, and start looking for evidence and be rational, and ask yourself the question, could the facts in this situation be explained in other ways? Or are there alternative interpretations I could give that would be more truthful and less painful? Often you can find that. And if so, what are they? Finding the evidence is very important when it comes to cognitive behavioral therapy. What is the evidence that this thought is true or false? If my best friend said this, what would I say to him or her? Often if someone else says something, you can get offended and triggered. But what if your best friend said something? When I'm not feeling this way, would I think this way? That's a sign that things are going wrong as well, because that's emotional reasoning because your feelings are driving your thoughts instead of the other way around. And then also ask yourself the question, what do ultimate sources of truth say? What are the ultimate sources of authority in your life? What do they say about the situation? And then once you reframe and restructure your thoughts, you're still not done. You now need to practice it. We've met individuals who are able to do this with help maybe once or twice, but they weren't practicing it. And practice, practice, practice is very important with cognitive behavioral therapy. Rational thoughts do not come easily to us. It's something that takes some work. And so, since it doesn't come naturally, it must be a conscious choice followed by strong effort. But the more balanced feelings that result will be worth the struggle and the effort to practice this by some self-discipline. So we've taught you the ABCs of cognitive behavioral therapy. The A is the activating event. The B is the belief. The C is the emotional consequence. But it actually goes all the way through G. When our emotional consequence is not good, and we're not feeling the way we want to feel, we have an opportunity to dispute our belief. The D is to dispute it. If the C doesn't come out good, it's time to go further. And the D is to dispute our belief. When we dispute our belief, our irrational beliefs can be replaced with true beliefs, and then the consequence can come out positively. Then we can evaluate. Is your disappointment really an appointment? If it is, we're doing well. And how is that affecting your future? And then finally, how is it affecting your goals, that motivational part, and your accomplishments? In your own circle, the community, and it can positively affect even the nation and the world. This is what can happen when our ABCs, our irrational beliefs, are replaced with true and rational beliefs, and it can affect us positively all the way. So what a difference it can make when you change your negative automatic thoughts to thoughts that are rational, balanced, accurate, and helpful. When you can practice listening to and correcting your thoughts, you can instantly start to feel better. And it can be instantaneous. Our patients that have gone through this and the ones that have gone through this course will tell us, once I'm able to do this, I can feel better instantly, and it works far quicker than popping a Xanax pill or taking some sort of drug. It works instantaneously. There's nothing that works quicker. And so there's no replacement that can make you feel better quicker than when you get good at cognitive behavioral therapy. So I appeal to you to embrace the concept of thought correction and replacement in your life. And if you do, you will open the door to becoming transformed. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so Bob Clough here. Sorry, I stopped it for a second, so I apologize for that. And it was right on the slide entitled Mind Reading, and I believe it was on the statement which talks about, can we mind read our spouses? And it says there is up to a 4 out of 5 chance that you'll be right with those that you are very close to. So it's not perfect, but it's 4 out of 5 chance that you'll be right. Whereas if it's a stranger, it's only 1 in 4. So 25% if it's a stranger, 80% if it's your spouse. All right. Sorry about that. Thank you. God bless. Bye.